Penguin Audio presents Matched by Ali Kandi, read by Kate Simses. Chapter 1. Now that I've found the way to fly, which direction should I go into the night? My wings aren't white or feathery. They're green, made of green silk, which shudders in the wind and bends when I move. First in a circle, then in a line, finally in a shape of my own invention. The black behind me doesn't worry me, neither do the stars ahead. I smile at myself, at the foolishness of my imagination. People cannot fly, though before the society, there were myths about those who could. I saw a painting of them once. White wings, blue sky, gold circles above their heads, eyes turned up in surprise as though they couldn't believe what the artist had painted them doing, couldn't believe that their feet didn't touch the ground. Those stories weren't true. I know that. But tonight, it's easy to forget. The air train glides through the starry night so smoothly and my heart pounds so quickly that it feels as though I could soar into the sky at any moment.
What are you smiling about?
Xander wonders as I smooth the folds of my green silk dress down neat. Everything, I tell him, and it's true. I've waited so long for this, for my match banquet, where I'll see for the first time the face of the boy who will be my match. It will be the first time I hear his name. I can't wait. As quickly as the air train moves, it still isn't fast enough. It hushes through the night, its sound a background for the low rain of our parents' voices, the lightning-quick beats of my heart. Perhaps Xander can hear my heart pounding too, because he asks,
"Are you nervous?"
In the seat next to him, Xander's older brother begins to tell my mother the story of his match banquet. It won't be long now until Xander and I have our own stories to tell. "No," I say.
"But Xander's my best friend. He knows me too well."
"You lie," he teases.
"You are nervous."
"Aren't you?"
"Not me. I'm ready."
He says it without hesitation, and I believe him. Xander is the kind of person who is sure about what he wants. "It doesn't matter if you're nervous, Kasia," he says, gentle now. "Almost 93% of those attending their match banquet exhibit some signs of nervousness."
"Did you memorize all of the official matching material?"
"Almost," Xander says, grinning. He holds his hands out as if to say, "What did you expect?" The gesture makes me laugh, and besides, I memorized all of the material too. It's easy to do when you read it so many times, when the decision is so important. "So you're in the minority," I say. "The 7% who don't show any nerves at all."
"Of course," he agrees.
"How could you tell I was nervous?"
"Because you keep opening and closing that?"
Xander points to the golden object in my hands.
"I didn't know you had an artifact."
A few treasures from the past float around among us. Though citizens of the society are allowed one artifact each, they are hard to come by, unless you had ancestors who took care to pass things along through the years. "I didn't until a few hours ago," I tell him. "Grandfather gave it to me for my birthday. It belonged to his mother."
"What's it called?"
Xander asks. "A compact," I say. I like the name very much. Compact means small. I am small. I also like the way it sounds when you say it. Compact. Saying the word makes a sound like the one the artifact itself makes when it snaps shut.
"What do the initials and numbers mean?"
"I'm not sure." I run my finger across the letters ACM and the numbers 1940 carved across the golden surface. "But look," I tell him, popping the compact open to show him the inside. A little mirror made of real glass and a small hollow where the original owner once stored powder for her face, according to Grandfather. Now I use it to hold the 3 emergency tablets that everyone carries. 1 green, 1 blue, 1 red.
"That's convenient,"
Xander says. He stretches out his arms in front of him, and I notice that he has an artifact too. A pair of shiny platinum cufflinks.
My father lent me these, but you can't put anything in them. They're completely useless. They look nice, though. My gaze travels up to Xander's face, to his bright blue eyes and blonde hair above his dark suit and white shirt. He's always been handsome, even when we were little, but I've never seen him dressed up like this. Boys don't have as much leeway in choosing clothes as girls do. One suit looks much like another. Still, they get to select the color of their shirts and cravats, and the quality of the material is much finer than the material used for plain clothes. You look nice. The girl who finds out that he's her match will be thrilled.
Nice, Xander says, lifting his eyebrows. That's all?
Xander, his mother says next to him, amusement mingled with the reproach in her voice.
You look beautiful,
Xander tells me, and I flush a little, even though I've known Xander all my life. I feel beautiful in this dress. Ice green, floating, full-skirted. The unaccustomed smoothness of silk against my skin makes me feel lithe and graceful. Next to me, my mother and father each draw a breath as City Hall comes into view, lit up white and blue and sparkling with the special occasion lights that indicate a celebration is taking place. I can't see the marble stairs in front of the hall yet, but I know that they will be polished and shining. All my life I have waited to walk up those clean marble steps and through the doors of the hall, a building I have seen from a distance but never entered. I want to open the compact and check in the mirror to make sure I look my best, but I don't want to seem vain, so I sneak a glance at my face in its surface instead. The rounded surface of the compact distorts my features a little, but it's still me. My green eyes, my coppery brown hair, which looks more golden in the compact than it does in real life. My straight, small nose, my chin with a trace of a dimple like my grandfather's. All the outward characteristics that make me Kasia Maria Reyes, 17 years old, exactly. I turn the compact over in my hands, looking at how perfectly the two sides fit together. My match is already coming together just as neatly, beginning with the fact that I am here tonight. Since my birthday falls on the 15th, the day the banquet is held each month, I'd always hoped that I might be matched on my actual birthday, but I knew it might not happen. You can be called up for your banquet any time during the year after you turn 17. When the notification came across the port 2 weeks ago that I would indeed be matched on my birthday, I could almost hear the clean snap of the pieces fitting into place, exactly as I'd dreamed for so long. Because although I haven't even had to wait a full day for my match, in some ways, I have waited all my life.
Kasia,
my mother says, smiling at me. I blink and look up startled. My parents stand up, ready to disembark. Xander stands too and straightens his sleeves. I hear him take a deep breath and I smile to myself. Maybe he is a little nervous after all.
Here we go,
he says to me. His smile is so kind and good. I'm glad we were called up the same month. We've shared so much of childhood. It seems we should share the end of it, too. I smile back at him and give him the best greeting we have in the society. I wish you optimal results, I tell Xander.
You too, Kasia, he says.
As we step off the air train and walk toward City Hall, my parents each link an arm through mine. I am surrounded, as I always have been, by their love. It is only the three of us tonight. My brother Bram can't come to the match banquet because he is under 17, too young to attend. The first one you attend is always your own. I, however, will be able to attend Bram's banquet because I am the older sibling. I smile to myself, wondering what Bram's match will be like. In 7 years, I will find out. But tonight is my night. It is easy to identify those of us being matched. Not only are we younger than all of the others, but we also float along in beautiful dresses and tailored suits while our parents and older siblings walk around in plain clothes, a background against which we bloom.
The city officials smile proudly at us, and my heart swells as we enter the rotunda. In addition to Xander, who waves goodbye to me as he crosses the room to his seating area, I see another girl I know named Leah. She picked the bright red dress. It is a good choice for her because she is beautiful enough that standing out works in her favor. She looks worried, however, and she keeps twisting her artifact, a beautiful red bracelet. I am a little surprised to see Leah there. I would have picked her for a single.
"Look at this china,"
my father says as we find our place at the banquet tables.
"It reminds me of the Wedgwood pieces we found last year."
My mother looks at me and rolls her eyes in amusement. Even at the match banquet, my father can't stop himself from noticing these things. My father spends months in old neighborhoods that are being restored and turned into new boroughs for public use. He sifts through the relics of a society that is not as far in the past as it seems. Right now, for example, he is working on a particularly interesting restoration project, an old library. He sorts out the things the society has marked as valuable from the things that are not. But then I have to laugh because my mother can't help but comment on the flowers, since they fall in her area of expertise as an arboretum worker. "Oh, Kasia, look at the centerpieces, lilies." She squeezes my hand.
"Please be seated,"
an official tells us from the podium.
"Dinner is about to be served."
It's almost comical how quickly we all take our seats, because we might admire the china and the flowers, and we might be here for our matches, but we also can't wait to taste the food.
"They say this dinner is always wasted on the matchees,"
a jovial-looking man sitting across from us says, smiling around our table.
"So excited they can't eat a bite."
And it's true. One of the girls sitting farther down the table, wearing a pink dress, stares at her plate, touching nothing. I don't seem to have this problem, however. Though I don't gorge myself, I can eat some of everything. The roasted vegetables, the savory meat, the crisp greens and creamy cheese, the warm, light bread. The meal seems like a dance, as though this is a ball as well as a banquet. The waiters slide the plates in front of us with graceful hands. The food, wearing herbs and garnishes, is as dressed up as we are. We lift the white napkins, the silver forks, the shining crystal goblets, as if in time to music. My father smiles happily as the server sets a piece of chocolate cake with fresh cream before him at the end of the meal.
"Wonderful,"
he whispers, so softly that only my mother and I can hear him. My mother laughs a little at him, teasing him, and he reaches for her hand. I understand his enthusiasm when I take a bite of the cake, which is rich but not overwhelming, deep and dark and flavorful. It is the best thing I have eaten since the traditional dinner at Winter Holiday, 5 months ago. I wish Bram could have some cake, and for a minute I think about saving some of mine for him, but there is no way to take it back to him. It wouldn't fit in my compact. It would be bad form to hide it away in my mother's purse, even if she would agree, and she won't. My mother doesn't break the rules. I can't save it for later. It is now or never. I have just popped the last bite in my mouth when the announcer says,
"We are ready to announce the matches."
I swallow in surprise, and for a second, I feel an unexpected surge of anger. I didn't get to savor my last bite of cake.
Leah Abbey.
Leah twists her bracelet furiously as she stands, waiting to see the face flash on the screen. She is careful to hold her hands low, though, so that the boy seeing her in another city hall somewhere will only see the beautiful blonde girl and not her worried hands, twisting and turning that bracelet. It is strange how we hold on to the pieces of the past while we wait for our futures. There is a system, of course, to the matching. In city halls across the country, all filled with people, the matches are announced in alphabetical order according to the girls' last names. I feel slightly sorry for the boys, who have no idea when their names will be called. when they must stand for girls in other city halls to receive them as matches. Since my last name is Reyes, I will be somewhere at the end of the middle, the beginning of the end. The screen flashes with the face of a boy, blonde and handsome. He smiles as he sees Leah's face on the screen where he is, and she smiles too.
Joseph Peterson,
the announcer says.
Leah Abbey, you have been matched with Joseph Peterson.
The hostess presiding over the banquet brings Leah a small silver box. The same thing happens to Joseph Peterson on the screen. When Leah sits down, she looks at the silver box longingly, as though she wishes she could open it right away. I don't blame her. Inside the box is a micro card with background information about her match. We all receive them. Later, the boxes will be used to hold the rings for the marriage contract. The screen flashes back to the default picture, a boy and a girl smiling at each other, with glimmering lights and a white-coated official in the background. Although the society times the matching to be as efficient as possible, there are still moments when the screen goes back to this picture, which means that we all wait while something happens somewhere else. It's so complicated, the matching, and I am again reminded of the intricate steps of the dances they used to do long ago. This dance, however, is one that the society alone can choreograph now. The picture shimmers away. The announcer calls another name. Another girl stands up. Soon, more and more people at the banquet have little silver boxes. Some people set them on the white tablecloths in front of them, but most hold the boxes carefully, unwilling to let their futures out of their hands so soon after receiving them. I don't see any other girls wearing the green dress. I don't mind. I like the idea that for one night, I don't look like everyone else. I wait, holding my compact in one hand and my mother's hand in the other. Her palm feels sweaty. For the first time, I realize that she and my father are nervous too.
Kasia Maria Reyes.
It is my turn. I stand up, letting go of my mother's hand, and turn toward the screen. I feel my heart pounding, and I am tempted to twist my hands the way Leah did, but I hold perfectly still, with my chin up and my eyes on the screen. I watch and wait, determined that the girl my match will see on the screen in his city hall somewhere out there in society will be poised and calm and lovely. The very best image of Kasia Maria Reyes that I can present. But nothing happens. I stand and look at the screen, and as the seconds go by, it is all I can do to stay still. All I can do to keep smiling. Whispers start around me. Out of the corner of my eye, I see my mother move her hand as if to take mine again. But then she pulls it back. A girl in a green dress stands waiting, her heart pounding. Me. The screen is dark, and it stays dark. That can only mean one thing. Chapter 2. The whispers rise soft around me, like birds beating their wings under the dome of City Hall.
Your match is here this evening,
the hostess says, smiling. The people around me smile as well, and their murmurs become louder. Our society is so vast, our cities so many, that the odds of your perfect match being someone in your own city are minuscule. It's been many years since such a thing happened here. These thoughts tumble in my mind, and I close my eyes briefly as I realize what this means. Not in abstract, but for me, the girl in the green dress. I might know my match. He might be someone who goes to the same second school that I do. Someone I see every day. Someone...
Xander Thomas Caro.
At his table, Xander stands up. A sea of watching faces and white tablecloths, of glinting crystal glasses and shining silver boxes stretches between us. I can't believe it. This is a dream. People turn their eyes on me and on the handsome boy in the dark suit and blue cravat. It doesn't feel real until Xander smiles at me. I think, I know that smile. And suddenly, I'm smiling too. And the rush of applause and smell of the lilies fully convince me that this is actually happening. Dreams don't smell or sound as strong as this. I break protocol a bit to give Xander a tiny wave, and his smile widens. The hostess says,
"You may take your seats."
She sounds glad that we are so happy. Of course, we should be. We are each other's best match, after all. When she brings me the silver box, I hold it carefully, but I already know much of what is inside. Not only do Xander and I go to the same school, we also live on the same street. We've been best friends for as long as I can remember. I don't need the microcard to show me pictures of Xander as a child, because I have plenty of them in my mind. I don't need to download a list of favorites to memorize, because I already know them. Favorite color, green. Favorite leisure activity, swimming. Favorite recreation activity, games.
"Congratulations, Kasia,"
my father whispers to me, his expression relieved. My mother says nothing, but she beams with delight and embraces me tightly. Behind her, another girl stands up, watching the screen. The man sitting next to my father whispers,
"What a piece of luck for your family. You don't have to trust her future to someone you know nothing about."
I'm surprised by the unhappy edge to his tone, the way his comment seems to be right on the verge of insubordination. His daughter, the nervous one wearing the pink dress, hears it too. She looks uncomfortable and shifts slightly in her seat. I don't recognize her. She must go to one of the other second schools in our city. I sneak another glance at Xander, but there are too many people in my way and I can't see him. Other girls take their turns standing up. The screen lights up for each of them. No one else has a dark screen. I am the only one. Before we leave, the hostess of the match banquet asks Xander and me and our families to step aside and speak with her.
"This is an unusual situation," she says, but she corrects herself immediately.
"Not unusual, excuse me. It is merely uncommon." She smiles at both of us.
"Since you already know each other, things will proceed differently for you. You will not have as much initial information to exchange."
She gestures at our silver boxes.
"There are a few new courtship guidelines included on your microcards, so you should familiarize yourselves with those when you have an opportunity."
"We'll read them tonight," Xander promises sincerely.
I try to keep from rolling my eyes in amusement because he sounds exactly the way he does when a teacher gives him a learning assignment. He'll read the new guidelines and memorize them as he read and memorized the official matching material. And then I flush again as a paragraph from that material flashes across my mind. "If you choose to be matched, your marriage contract will take place when you are 21. Studies have shown that the fertility of both men and women peaks at the age of 24. The matching system has been constructed to allow those who match to have their children near this age, providing for the highest likelihood of healthy offspring." Xander and I will share a marriage contract. We will have children together. I don't have to spend the next few years learning everything about him because I already know him, almost as well as I know myself. The tiny feeling of loss deep within my heart surprises me. My peers will spend the next few days swooning over pictures of their matches, bragging about them during meal hour at school, waiting for more and more bits of information to be revealed, anticipating their first meeting, their second meeting, and so on. That mystery does not exist for Xander and me. I won't wonder what he is like or daydream about our first meeting. But then Xander looks at me and asks,
"What are you thinking about?"
And I answer, "That we are very lucky. and I mean it. There is still much to discover. Until now, I have only known Xander as a friend. Now, he is my match. The hostess corrects me gently.
Not lucky, Kasia. There is no luck in the society.
I nod. Of course. I should know better than to use such an archaic, inaccurate term. There's only probability now. How likely something is to occur, or how unlikely. The hostess speaks again.
It has been a busy evening, and it's getting late. You can read the courtship guidelines later, another day. There's plenty of time.
She's right. That's what the society has given us. Time. We live longer and better than any other citizens in the history of the world. And it's thanks in large part to the matching system, which produces physically and emotionally healthy offspring. And I'm a part of it all. My parents and the Caros can't stop exclaiming over how wonderful this all is. And as we walk down the steps of City Hall together, Xander leans over and says,
"You'd think they'd arranged everything themselves."
"I can't believe it," I say, and I feel opulent and a little giddy. I can't believe that this is me, wearing a beautiful green dress, holding gold in one hand and silver in the other, walking next to my best friend, my match.
"I can," Xander says, teasing me. "In fact, I knew all along. That's why I wasn't nervous."
I tease him back. "I knew too. That's why I was." We're laughing so much that when the air train pulls up, neither of us notice for a moment. And then there is a brief moment of awkwardness as Xander holds out his hand to help me climb aboard.
"Here," he says, his voice serious. For a moment, I don't know what to do.
There is something new in touching each other now, and my hands are full. Then Xander wraps his hand around mine, pulling me onto the train with him. "Thank you," I say as the doors close behind us.
"Anytime," he says.
He does not let go of my hand. The little silver box I hold creates a barrier between us, even as another one breaks. We have not held hands like this since we were children. In doing that tonight, we move across the invisible divide that separates friendship from something more. I feel a tingle along my arm. To be touched by my match is a luxury that the other matchees at banquets tonight do not share. The air train carries us away from the sparkling, icy white lights of City Hall toward the softer yellow porch lights and street lights of the boroughs. As the streets flash past on our way home to Mapletree Borough, I glance over at Xander. The gold of the lights outside is similar to the color of his hair, and his face is handsome and confident and good, and familiar, for the most part. If you've always known how to look at someone, it's strange when that directive changes. Xander has always been someone I could not have, and I have been the same for him. Now everything is different. My 10-year-old brother Bram waits for us on the front porch. When we tell him about the banquet, he can't believe the news.
"You're matched with Xander? I already know the person you're going to marry? That's so strange."
"You're the one who's strange," I tease him, and he dodges me as I pretend to grab him. "Who knows? Maybe your match lives right on this street, too. Maybe it's..." Bram covers his ears.
"Don't say it! Don't say it!"
"Serena," I say, and he turns away, pretending that he didn't hear me. Serena lives next door. She and Bram torment each other incessantly.
"Kasia,"
my mother says disapprovingly, glancing around to make sure that no one heard. "We are not supposed to disparage other members of our street and our community. Mapletree Borough is known for being tight-knit and exemplary in this way." No thanks to Bram, I think to myself. I'm teasing, Mama. I know she can't stay mad at me. Not on the night of my match banquet, when she has been reminded of how quickly I am growing up.
come inside, my father says. It's almost curfew. We can talk about everything tomorrow.
Was there cake?
Bram asks as my father opens the door. They all look back at me, waiting. I don't move. I don't want to go inside yet. If I do, that means that this night is coming to an end, and I don't want that. I don't want to take off the dress and go back to my plain clothes. I don't want to return to the usual days, which are good, but nothing special like this. I'll come in soon, just a few minutes more.
Don't be long,
my father says gently. He doesn't want me to break curfew. It is the city's curfew, not his, and I understand. I won't, I promise. I sit down on the steps of my house, careful, of course, of my borrowed dress. I glance down at the folds of the beautiful material. It does not belong to me, but this evening does. This time that is dark and bright and full of both the unexpected and the familiar. I look out into the new spring night and turn my face to the stars. I don't linger outside for long because tomorrow, Saturday, is a busy day. I'll need to report to my trial work position at the sorting center early in the morning. After that, I'll have my Saturday night free rec hours, one of the few times I get to spend with my friends outside of second school. And Xander will be there. Back in my bedroom, I shake the tablets out of the little hollow in the base of the compact. Then I count 1, 2, 3, green, blue, red, as I slide the tablets back into their usual metal cylinder. I know what the green and blue tablets do. I don't know anyone who knows for certain what the red tablet does. There have been rumors about it for years. I climb into bed and push away thoughts of the red tablet. For the first time in my life, I'm allowed to dream of Xander. Chapter 3. I've always wondered what my dreams look like on paper, in numbers. Someone out there knows, but it isn't me. I pull the sleep tags from my skin, taking care not to tug too hard on the one behind my ear. The skin is fragile there, and it always hurts to peel the disc away, especially if a strand or two of hair gets caught under the adhesive on the tag. Glad that my turn is over, I put the equipment back in its box. It's Bram's turn to be tagged tonight. I did not dream of Xander. I don't know why. But I did sleep late, and I'm going to be late for work if I don't hurry. As I walk into the kitchen carrying my dress from the night before, I see that my mother has already set out the breakfast food delivery. Oatmeal, gray-brown, and expected. We eat for health and performance, not for taste. Holidays and celebrations are exceptions. Our calories had been moderated all week long, so last night at the banquet we could eat everything in front of us without significant impact. Bram grins mischievously at me, still wearing his sleep clothes. So, he says, shoving one last spoonful of oatmeal into his mouth.
Did you sleep in because you were dreaming about Xander?
I don't want him to know how close he is to the truth. That even though I didn't dream of Xander, I wanted to. No, I say. And aren't you going to be late for school again? Bram's young enough that he still has school instead of work on Saturdays. And if he doesn't get going, he'll be late. Again. I hope he doesn't get sighted. Bram, my mother says, go get your plain clothes on, please. She'll breathe a huge sigh of relief when he moves on to second school, where the start time is half an hour later. As Bram slouches out of the room, my mother reaches for my dress and holds it up. You looked so beautiful last night. I hate to take this back. We both look at the gown for a moment. I admire the way the fabric catches the light and plays it back, almost like the light and the cloth are both living things. We both sigh at exactly the same time, and my mother laughs. She gives me a kiss on the cheek. They'll send you a little piece of the fabric, remember? She says, and I nod. Each gown is designed with an interior panel that can be cut into pieces, one for each girl who wears the dress. The scrap, along with the silver box that held my microcard, will be the mementos of my matching. But still, I will never see this dress, my green dress, again. I knew the moment I saw it that it was the one I wanted. When I made my selection, the woman at the clothing distribution center smiled after she punched the number, 73, into the computer.
"That's the one you were most likely to pick," she said.
"Your personal data indicated it, and so did general psychology. You've picked things outside of the majority in the past, and girls like their dresses to bring out their eyes." I smiled and watched as she sent her assistant into the back to retrieve the dress. When I tried it on, I saw that she was right. The dress was meant for me. The hemline fell perfectly. The waist curved in exactly the right amount. I turned in front of the mirror, admiring myself. The woman told me,
"So far, you are the only girl wearing this dress at the match banquet this month. The most popular gown is one of the pink gowns, number 22.
"Good," I told her. "I don't mind standing out a little." Bram reappears in the doorway, plainclothes wrinkled, hair askew. I can almost see the wheels turning in my mother's mind. Is it better to comb his hair and make him late, or send him as he is? Bram makes the decision for her.
"See you tonight,"
he says, sprinting out the door. He's never going to make it. My mother looks out the window toward the air train stop, where the tracks light up to indicate the approaching train.
"He might," I say, watching Bram as he breaks another rule, the one about running in public.
I can almost hear his footsteps pounding on the sidewalk as he runs down the street, his head lowered, his school pack bumping against his skinny back. Right when he gets to the stop, he slows down. He pats his hair into place and walks casually up the steps toward the train. Hopefully, no one else has seen him run. A moment later, the air train pulls away with Bram safely inside.
"That boy is going to be the end of me," my mother sighs. "I should have gotten him up earlier. We all overslept. It was a big night last night."
"It was," I agree.
"I have to catch the next city air train." My mother pulls her satchel over her shoulder. "What are you doing for your free rec hours tonight?"
"I'm sure Xander and everyone will want to play games at the youth center," I say. "We've seen all the showings, and the music..." I shrug. My mother laughs, completing my sentence.
"Is for old people like me."
And I'm using the last hour to visit Grandfather. The officials don't often allow a deviation from the usual free rec options, but on the eve of someone's final banquet, visiting is encouraged and permitted. My mother's eyes soften. "He'll love that." "Did Papa tell Grandfather about my match?" My mother smiles. "He planned to stop by on his way to work." "Good," I say, because I want Grandfather to know as soon as possible. I know he has been thinking as much about me and my banquet as I've been thinking about him and his. After I hurry and eat my breakfast, I make my train with seconds to spare and sit back. I may not have dreamed about Xander while I slept, but I can daydream about him now. Looking out the window and thinking about how he looked last night in his suit, I watch the burrows slide by on my way into the city. The green has not yet given way to stone and concrete when I notice white flakes drifting through the sky. Everyone else notices them, too.
"Snow in June?"
the woman next to me asks.
"It can't be,"
a man across the aisle mutters. "But look at it," she says.
"It can't be,"
the man says again. People twist, turn to the windows, looking agitated. Can something wrong be true? Sure enough, little white puffs drift past on their way to the ground. There is something strange about this snow, but I'm not exactly sure what. I find myself holding in a smile as I look at all the worried faces around me. Should I be worried, too? Perhaps, but it's so pretty, so unexpected, and, for the moment, so unexplainable. The air train comes to a stop. The doors open and a few pieces drift inside. I catch one on my hand, but it does not melt. The mystery of it does, however, when I see the little brown seed at the center of the snow.
It's a cottonwood seed, I tell everyone confidently. It's not snow.
Of course,
the man says, sounding glad to have an explanation. Snow in June would be atypical. Cottonwood seeds are not.
But why are there so many? Another woman asks, still worried.
In a moment, we have our answer. One of the new passengers sitting down brushes white from his hair and plain clothes.
We're tearing out the cottonwood grove along the river, he explains. The society wants to plant some better trees there.
Everyone else takes his word for it. They know nothing about trees. They mutter about being glad it isn't a sign of another warming. Thank goodness the society has things under control, as usual. But thanks to my mother, who can't help talking about her work as a caretaker at the Arboretum, I know that his explanation does make sense. You can't use cottonwood trees for fruit or fuel, and their seeds are a nuisance. They fly far, catch on anything, try to grow everywhere. Weed trees, my mother says. Still, she harbors a particular affinity for them because of the seeds, which are small and brown but cloaked in beauty in these thin white tendrils of cotton. Little cloudy parachutes to slow their fall, to help them fly, to catch the wind and glide them somewhere they might grow. I look at the seed resting in the palm of my hand. There is still mystery in it after all, in that little brown core. I'm not sure what to do with it, so I tuck it into my pocket next to my tablet container. The almost snow reminds me of a line from a poem we studied this year in language and literacy. Stopping by woods on a snowy evening. It is one of my favorites of all the 100 poems, the ones our society chose to keep, back when they decided our culture was too cluttered. They created commissions to choose the 100 best of everything. 100 songs, 100 paintings, 100 stories, 100 poems. The rest were eliminated, gone forever. For the best, the society said. And everyone believed because it made sense. How can we appreciate anything fully when overwhelmed with too much? My own great-grandmother was one of the cultural historians who helped select the 100 poems almost 70 years ago. Grandfather has told me the story 1,000 times, how his mother had to help decide which poems to keep and which to lose forever. She used to sing him parts of the poems as lullabies. She whispered, sang them, he said, and I tried to remember them after she had gone. After she had gone. Tomorrow, my grandfather will go too. As we leave the last of the cottonwood seeds behind, I think about that poem and how much I like it. I like the words deep and sleep and the way they rhyme and repeat. I think to myself that this poem would be a good lullaby if you listen to the rhythm instead of the words. Because if you listen to the words, you wouldn't feel rested. Miles to go before I sleep.
It's a number sort today,
my supervisor Nora tells me. I sigh a little, but Nora doesn't respond. She scans my card and hands it back. She doesn't ask about the match banquet, even though she has to know from my information update that it happened last night. But that's nothing new. Nora barely interacts with me because I'm one of the best sorters. In fact, it's been almost 3 months since my last error, which was the last time the two of us had a real conversation.
Wait, Nora says as I turn toward my station. Your scan card indicates that it's almost time for your formal sorting test.
I nod. I've been thinking about this for months. Not as much as I thought about my match banquet, but often. Even though some of these number sorts are boring, sorting itself can lead to much more interesting work positions. Perhaps I could be a restoration supervisor, like my father. When he was my age, his work activity was information sorting, too. And so was grandfather's. And of course there is my great-grandmother, the one who participated in one of the greatest sortings of all when she was on the 100 committee. The people who oversee the matching also get their start in sorting, but I'm not interested in that. I like my stories and information one step removed. I don't want to be in charge of sorting real people.
Make sure you're ready,
Nora says. But both she and I know that I already am. Yellow light slants through the windows near our stations in the sorting center. I cast a shadow across the other workers' stations as I pass by. No one looks up. I slip into my tiny station, which is just wide enough for a table and a chair and a sorting screen. The thin gray walls rise up on either side of me, and I can't see anyone else. We are like the microcards in the research library at second school, each of us neatly tucked into a slot. The government has computers that can do sorts much faster than we can, of course, but we're still important. You never know when technology might fail. That's what happened to the society before ours. Everyone had technology, too much of it, and the consequences were disastrous. Now we have the basic technology we need: ports, readers, scribes, and our information intake is much more specific. Nutrition specialists don't need to know how to program air trains, and sorters don't need to know how to research diseases. Such specialization keeps people from becoming overwhelmed. We don't need to understand everything. And, as the society reminds us, there's a difference between knowledge and technology. Knowledge doesn't fail us. I slide my scan card and the sort begins. Even though I like word association or picture or sentence sorts the best, I'm good at the number ones too. The screen tells me what patterns I'm supposed to find, and the numbers begin to scroll up on the screen, like little white soldiers on a black field waiting for me to mow them down. I touch each one and begin to sort them out, pulling them aside into different boxes. The tapping of my fingers makes a low, soft sound, almost as silent as snow falling. And I create a storm. The numbers fly into their spots like flakes driven by the wind. Halfway through, the pattern we are looking for changes. The system tracks how soon we notice the changes and how quickly we adapt our sorts. You never know when a change will happen. 2 minutes later, the pattern changes again, and once again I catch it on the very first line of numbers. I don't know how, but I always anticipate the shift in pattern before it happens. When I sort, there is only time to think about what I see in front of me. So there, in my little gray space, I don't think about Xander. I don't wish for the feel of the green dress against my skin or the taste of chocolate cake on my tongue. I don't think of my grandfather eating his last meal tomorrow night at the final banquet. I don't think of snow in June or other things that cannot be, yet somehow are. I don't picture the sun dazzling me or the moon cooling me or the maple tree in our yard turning gold, green, red. I will think of all of those things and more later, but not when I sort. I sort and sort and sort until there is no data left for me. Everything is clear on my screen. I am the one who makes it go blank. When I ride the air train back to Maple Tree Burrow, the cottonwood seeds are gone. I want to tell my mother about them, but when I get home, she and my father and Bram have already left for their leisure hours. A message for me blinks on the port. "Sorry we missed you, Kasia," it flashes. "Have a good night." A beep sounds in the kitchen. My meal has arrived. The foilware container slides through the food delivery slot. I pick it up quickly, in time to hear the sound of the nutrition vehicle trundling along its track behind the houses in the borough. My dinner steams as I open it up. We must have a new nutrition personnel director. Before, the food was always lukewarm when it arrived. Now it's piping hot. I eat in a hurry, burning my mouth a little because I know what I want to do with this rare empty time in this almost vacant house. I'm never really alone. The port hums in the background, keeping track, keeping watch. But that's all right. I need it for what I'm going to do. I want to look at the microcard without my parents or Bram glancing over my shoulder. I want to read more about Xander before I see him tonight. When I insert the microcard, the humming takes on a more purposeful sound. The port screen brightens and my heart beats faster in anticipation, even though I know Xander so well. What has the society decided I should know about him, the person I'll spend most of my life with? Do I know everything about him as I think I do, or is there something I've missed?
Kasia Reyes, the society is pleased to present you with your match.
I smile as Xander's face appears on the port screen immediately following the recorded message. It's a good picture of him. As always, his smile looks bright and real, his blue eyes kind. I study his face closely, pretending that I've never seen this picture before, that I have only had a glimpse of him once, last night at the banquet. I study the planes of his face, the look of his lips. He is handsome. I'd never dared think that he might be my match, of course. But now that it's happened, I am interested, intrigued, a little scared about how this might change our friendship, but mostly just happy. I reach up to touch the words courtship guidelines on the screen, but before I do, Xander's face darkens and then disappears. The port screen beeps and the voice says again,
Kasia Reyes, the society is pleased to present you with your match.
My heart stops, and I can't believe what I see. A face comes back into view on the port in front of me. It is not Xander. Chapter 4. What? Completely startled, I touch the screen and the face dissolves under my fingertips, pixelating into specks that look like dust. Words appear, but before I can read them, the screen goes completely blank. Again. What's going on? I say out loud. The port screen stays blank. I feel blank, too. This is 1,000 times worse than the empty screen last night. I knew what it meant then. I have no idea what it means now. I've never heard of this happening. I don't understand. The society doesn't make mistakes. But what else could this be? No one has 2 matches. Kasia? Xander calls to me through the door. I'm coming, I call out, tearing the microcard from the port and shoving it into my pocket. I take 1 deep breath, and then I open the door.
So, I learned from your microcard that you like cycling, Xander says formally as I close the door behind me, making me laugh a little in spite of what just happened. I hate cycling the most out of all the exercise options, and he knows it. We argue about it all the time. I think it's stupid to go riding on something that doesn't move, spinning your wheels endlessly. He points out that I like to run on the tracker, which is almost the same thing. It's different, I tell him. But I can't explain why.
Did you spend all day staring at my face on the port screen? He asks.
He's still joking, but suddenly I can't catch my breath. He viewed his microcard too. Was my face the one he saw? It feels so strange to be hiding something, especially from Xander. Of course not, I say, trying to tease back. It's Saturday, remember? I had work to do.
I did too, but that didn't stop me. I read all your stats and reviewed all the courtship guidelines.
He unknowingly throws me a lifeline with those words. I am not drowning in worry anymore. I am neck deep and it still washes over me in cold waves, but now I can breathe. Xander still thinks we are matched. Nothing strange happened to him when he viewed his microcard. That's something, at least. You read all the guidelines?
Of course, didn't you?
Not yet. I feel stupid admitting this, but Xander laughs again.
They're not very interesting, he says, except for one.
He winks at me significantly. Oh, I say, distracted. I see other youth our age mingling and gathering on our street, walking to the game center like us. They're waving, calling, wearing the same clothes we wear. But there's a difference tonight. Some are watching. Some are watched. Me and Xander. The others' eyes glance at us. Hold, flicker away, look back. I'm not used to it. Xander and I are normal, healthy citizens, part of this group, not outsiders. But I feel separated now, as though a clear, thin wall rises up distinctly between myself and those staring at me. We can see each other, but we can't cross over.
Are you all right?
Xander asks. Too late. I realize that I should have responded to Xander's comment and asked him which guideline he found interesting. If I can't pull myself together soon, he'll know something's wrong. We know each other too well. Xander reaches for my elbow as we turn the corner and leave Maple Tree Burrow. When we've walked a few steps more, he slides his hand down my arm and interlaces his fingers with mine. He leans closer to my ear.
One of the guidelines said that we are allowed to express physical affection, if we want.
And I do want. Even with all the stress I feel, the touch of his hand against mine with nothing to separate us is still welcome and new. I'm surprised that Xander is so natural at this. And as we walk, I recognize the emotion that I see on some of the faces of the girls staring at us. It's jealousy, pure and simple. I relax a little, because I can understand why. None of us ever thought we could have golden, charismatic, clever Xander. We always knew he would be matched with another girl in another city, another province. But he's not. He's matched with me. I keep my fingers locked in his as we walk toward the game center. Maybe if I don't let go, it will prove that we are meant to be matched. That the other face on the screen means nothing. That it was simply a momentary malfunction of the microcard. Except, the face I saw, the face that was not Xander, I knew him too. Chapter 5.
There's an opening over here,
Xander says, stopping at a game table in the middle of the room. Apparently, the other youth in our borough feel the same way we do about this Saturday's recreation options, because the game center is crowded with people, including most of our friends.
Do you want to go in, Kasia?
No thanks, I say. I'll watch this round.
What about you?
He asks Em, my best girlfriend.
You go ahead, she tells him.
And then we both laugh as he grins and spins around to give his scan card to the official monitoring the game. Xander's always been this way about the games, completely alive with energy and anticipation. I remember playing with him when we were little, how we both played hard and didn't let the other win. I wonder when I stopped liking the games. It's hard to remember. Now Xander settles himself at the table, saying something that makes everyone else laugh. I smile to myself. It really is more fun to watch him than to play yourself. And this game, check, is one of his favorites. It's a game of skill, the kind he likes best.
So, Em says softly, the sounds of laughter and talking covering her words from everyone but me. What is it like knowing your match?
I knew she would ask me this. I know it's what everyone would like to know, and I answer the only way I can. I tell her the truth. It's Xander, I say. It's wonderful. Em nods in understanding.
All this time, none of us thought we could ever end up with one another, she says. And then it happens.
I know, I say.
And Xander, she says. He's the best of us all.
Someone calls her name and she drifts toward another table. As I watch, Xander picks up the gray pieces and puts them out on the gray and black squares of the board. Most of the colors inside the game center are drab. Gray walls, brown plainclothes for the students, dark blue plainclothes for those who have already received their permanent work positions. Any brightness in the room comes from us, from the shades of our hair, from our laughter. When Xander sets down his last piece, he looks across the board at me and says right in front of his opponents,
"I'm going to win this one for my match."
Everyone turns to stare at me, and he grins mischievously. I roll my eyes at him, but I'm still blushing a few moments later when someone taps me on the shoulder. I turn around. An official waits behind me.
Cassia Reyes?
She asks. Yes, I answer, glancing over at Xander. He's engrossed in making his move and doesn't see what's happening.
Could you come outside with me for a moment? It won't take long, and it's nothing to worry about. Merely procedural.
Does the official know what happened when I tried to view the microcard? Of course, I say, because there's no other answer when an official asks you for something. I look back at my friends. Their eyes are on the game in front of them and on the players moving the pieces. No one notices when I leave. Not even Xander. The crowd swallows me up and I follow the official's white uniform out of the room.
Let me reassure you that you have nothing to worry about,
the official tells me, smiling. Her voice sounds kind. She leads me to the small green space outside of the center. Even though being with an official adds to my nervousness, the open air feels good after the crowd inside. We walk across the neatly cut grass toward a metal bench that sits directly underneath a street lamp. There's not another person in sight.
You don't even have to tell me what happened, the official says. I know. The face on the microcard wasn't the right one, was it?
She is kind. She didn't make me say the words. I nod.
You must be very worried. Have you told anyone what happened?
No, I say. She gestures for me to sit down on the bench, and so I do.
Excellent. Let me set your mind at ease.
She looks directly into my eyes.
Cassia, absolutely nothing has changed. You are still matched with Xander Caro.
Thank you, I say, and I'm so grateful that saying it once isn't enough. Thank you.